no surprise that newsmakers try to manipulate the audience. They want you to believe that they are the one holding the line, and they'll use any trick they can to get you there. But don't let them fool you. Get unspun. I'm Amanda Sturgill. I've been a reporter, and today I teach future reporters to cut the spin and think critically about what newsmakers say. My podcast, Unspun, shows you how to know when you're being manipulated by the news. Learn to spot the tricks and how to make up your own mind about what's true. So if you're tired of being fooled by the news, subscribe to Unspun today. Unspun, because you deserve the truth.
Pacific Northwest vibes. You know, that's, I would listen to the shit out of that.
In the late 1800s, the West really was wild, where the American dream was alive. And by the American dream, I mean stealing from the government. Today, I've got a scandalous tale of greed and corruption spanning four decades involving millionaire tycoons, U.S. senators, and even a belly dancer.
History is messy.
Weird, wild, anything but boring.
We're rainy day rabbit holes.
Exploring the unhinged side of history, politics, and culture.
Let's fall down the rabbit hole.
Welcome back to another episode of Rainy Day Rabbit Holes. Today, we have not one, but two very special guests joining us. First, we're thrilled to welcome Allison Gill, the brilliant host of the Daily Beans podcast, plus many, many more. And she is also the head of the MSW Media Group.
Hello.
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 Allison spends her days up to her elbows in today's political scandals, diving deep into the latest headlines and unraveling the complexities of our current political landscape. So welcome, Allison. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Am I doing this right? Hello. Hello.
I know. If you need any tips or tricks.
The countdown was fantastic, you guys. Yeah.
Why, thank you. Do you see it? We're in sync.
I want to see you guys do that blindfolded. We'll see how well it goes then.
No, but thank you for having me. Seriously, this is great.
We are so thrilled over the moon to have you on the show today. We've been talking about it since you said, hey, I'll come on your show.
So excited.
So I want to take a moment and, I mean, just thank you for being here, because you record, what, 5 to 13 episodes a week? Something like that?
I have usually 9 shows a week. And then if I'm on tour, you add those shows right on top of it, because I write different shows for the live shows as well. I don't like to do repeats. So right.
We do appreciate you being here on your free time doing something that you normally do for a living. So
yes,
thank you.
I'm a nurse. I get called to bandage changes and skin checks and suture removal. So I get it.
Speaking
yeah,
of
I know I have something I want
look at.
You to take a look at. Yeah.
See? I'm here for it. Definitely.
So, I mean, both Jody and I listen to Daily Beans pretty much every day. We really appreciate it because you give us the political news we need without screaming.
But with swearing,
which I like. And with Eddie Izzard references.
Those are important. I find that if you leave Eddie Izzard out of your news narrative, there's really something missing.
It is. It just doesn't hit the same way. Mm-hmm. It's just not quite as, doesn't have the journalistic standards mm-hmm. without fact, the Eddie Izzard quotes.
In fact, I record the show covered in bees.
Okay. Because you like your coffee like you like your women?
Right. With a spoon in them.
Oh, ouch.
Actually, I like my coffee like I like my men. Sliding off of the top of the car as I drive away. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Thank you. Someone tweeted that. I credit where credit is due. I can't remember who it was. That's not my joke, but I love it.
I love it.
So also joining Allison is our other very special guest, and that's mine own big brother, not quite as good looking as me, but probably more intelligent. My big brother Jason. Hi, Jason.
Not probably.
Visiting all the way from Phoenix, Arizona.
I know. I finally got to meet Allison.
Yeah. I mean, it was your life's ambition.
Yeah, I know. Finally got to actually meet her.
Okay. So I've known Jason since we went to college together in the early 90s.
College round one. Yeah.
That's awesome.
That is awesome. That is a long time because, yeah, that's like 30 years.
Yeah. And to still be close today.
Well, I know because that's how long I've been married.
10 years ago. I mean by the looks of you.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah, no, we met in at Northern Arizona University, where I was a creative writing major, and you were a what?
Civil engineer
barely
major.
Going to school.
Party time.
Majored in fed.
Professional fuck up.
Yes. Well, you've recovered from that.
Yeah.
Now you're a college professor.
I know, Professor Jason.
Enough,
that's so weird to say.
In addition to the stuff. Yeah, there you go.
But let's get into what we are here for. Today we wanted to give Allison a break from the chaos of modern politics. I know. It's like taking your bra off.
Okay.
Don't do that, though.
Sweet.
We're going.
I can take my bra off.
You can take your bra off. Yes. Or those man titties.
Wow, Jason, I didn't expect it to be so lacy.
I'm fancy.
That's real pretty.
Is that a heart in the middle?
Hey, it makes me feel sexy. Okay? That's what counts.
Oh, wait, it's a bow.
I mean, it just didn't seem like
that
you.
That front closer, too. That is really well. That's well chosen.
It
yes.
must be the gotta make frozen it easy. Shoulder. Every
oh, it's a little push-up. I didn't realize that wasn't all him. So we're going to take a trip back in time to discuss political scandals.
Do-do-do, do-do-do, do-do-do.
Thank you. I was going to just add that in post, but now I don't have to.
Yeah, nice.
So we're going to discuss political scandals where everyone is already dead.
Oh.
So we can make fun of their mustaches to our heart's content.
It's like modern politics in that we won't hold anyone accountable.
Okay.
The end. That's the whole story. Thank you, everyone, for being. Okay. All right. You guys ready? I'm going to set the mood.
Set it.
The dawn's first light filtered through the towering canopy of ancient redwoods, casting ethereal beams upon the forest floor below. Each giant stood like a sentinel of time, their immense trunks draped in verdant mosses and delicate ferns, whispering secrets of centuries past. In the tranquil silence, the only sounds were the gentle rustle of leaves high above, the melody of a few songbirds, and the distant murmur of a hidden stream. The air was cool and crisp, tinged with the earthy aroma of pine and damp soil, a testament to the unspoiled wilderness that lay untouched by human hands. Here, in this sacred grove, the redwoods reigned supreme. It could have been a time before humans ever stepped foot on the dense carpet of needles. Unfortunately, it was 1875. The sharp, rhythmic clanging of axes striking wood broke through the sacred silence, sending the birds into the air. Men shouted commands, and the saws, wielded by pairs of dirty lumberjacks, groaned and screeched as they bit into the dense trunks. The cracking and popping of splintering wood added to the din, and a deep, resonant creaking filled the air. The creaking grew into a mighty roar as the majestic, ancient tree crashed to the ground with a thunderous boom, shaking the earth. The timbermen had arrived, and the vast groves of trees that covered the fertile lands in Northern California and Oregon would soon fall under the axe and colossal greed of humankind.
Wow, Shay, you went hard on your creative writing skills.
Wait, I wasn't going to get a boom, boom, boom.
Oh, boom, boom, boom,
boom, boom.
Oh, yeah,
you
boom.
And
you.
My mom was really upset because she planted the redwoods.
Ouch. Oh, wow.
Sorry, I got a birthday card from my mom one year, and it said the redwoods on the front, and it said, "The you remind me of the steadfastness of the beauty and of the redwoods, et cetera, et cetera." Like kind of what your opening was, and you open it up, and it says, "Thanks for planting them." Happy birthday!
That's amazing.
Did she have a mailbox at Machu Picchu as well?
Right.
Laid those first stones for the pyramids.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
So one man stood by while the burly, bearded men labored. Let's pause for a moment. Picture a lumberjack.
Yeah.
No, not the 1880s kind.
Oh.
But the kind you'd see on Instagram.
Wait, why am I disappointed?
Chopping wood with his shirt off.
On Instagram, huh?
Mm-hmm. Have you not seen the...
That's what I'm talking about.
The guy, yeah, yeah. Well, we were in the 1880s. I didn't want anybody to think of an 1880s lumberjack because he's probably scrawny and really dirty and smells.
Hey, you know, I'm not picturing
like,
that.
No?
There were lumberjanes, so, no.
Oh, okay. That's what you're going for. Yeah. No, I'm going for the guy chopping wood with his shirt off on Instagram. Maybe in a kilt.
They had, there's probably a handful of lumberjacks in the 1880s that showered.
Possibly.
And read books.
There's probably a couple lumberjanes that didn't have beards either. Sure. So that's good.
All right. So now we've got that image. You guys are fucking perverts. Anyway, the man standing by, he was a slight man with small glasses perched on his long nose. He pushed his hat back on his head and made some notes in the dog-eared notebook he carried. Meet Stephen Arnold Douglas Pewter, or Sad P for short.
Little Sad P.
Is that
Sad
his rapper P. name?
What's up, Sad Tiny. P? Either that or he's got a medical issue and needs to get looked at.
Right. An unassuming man who was actually one of the most important figures in the timber industry. He's the guy who knew where the good timber was, when it would be available for plunder, whose palms to grease to get it. You're looking at the Land Fraud King.
Dun, dun, dun.
Self-titled.
Self-taught. Oh, he titled himself.
He titled himself the Land Fraud King.
He did? He called himself the Land Fraud King? Mm-hmm. That's like when my friend Lev Parnas and Rudy Giuliani put together their business called Fraud Guarantee. You were pretty much guaranteed a fraud, and it was funded by a very fantastic man, Dmitry Firtash. Wonderful man. Russian. Love him.
Oh, man. It all started innocently enough. Stephen began as an axeman for the United States Deputy Surveyor, helping to map and survey public lands in the West. It was a good job, although physically strenuous. He would cruise. That's what they called it back then. It's not what you're thinking of.
I was going to say.
He would cruise the plats that they were working on surveying, cutting vegetation, clearing line of sight paths.
So the definition of cruising has changed.
It has changed.
Axeman.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe he might have been into those sexy lumberjacks.
Just standing out there in the trees while everybody's cutting around him, just ripping it.
You a drummer? No, I'm more of an axe man. Land Fraud King.
Exactly.
Or, you know, and another person I'm reminded of is the subprime car loan king.
Yeah. Yes.
That guy who went out and lied and said he was a florist and would call active duty service members and trick them so that he could come and illegally repossess their cars, which had exorbitant interest rates on them.
Oh.
That's the guy who actually guaranteed Trump's bond, $175 million bond,
nice,
for his $464 million disgorgement fine that was just awarded to New York Attorney General Letitia James. Anyway, so we got subprime car loan guy. We got the fraud guarantee guy. What we might as well throw in the sausage king of Chicago.
Land Fraud King.
Did the pillow guy ever call himself the pillow king?
I've heard him referred to as the pillow magnate.
There we go.
That's really funny to me.
The pillows are.
But he has also liquidated everything that he owns and filed for bankruptcy. So, womp womp.
Stephen, or Sad P, was also learning a lot at this job. Beyond the technical aspects of surveying, he was also learning the legal framework of the various land laws. That might come in handy later. Now, let's talk about two crucial pieces of legislation for our story. You ready? I saw you perk up. You're like, legislation? Legislation?
I'm ready. We were just at Owl and Thistle. They have all the legislation books on the wall.
So first up, the Homestead Act of 1862. Have you heard of this one?
I have heard of the Homestead Act.
It aimed to promote the settlement and development of the American West. It allowed any adult U.S. citizen or, and remember this loophole, any adult who intended to become a citizen to claim up to 160 acres of public land to be homesteaded. Now, there were certain requirements. Claimants were required to live on the land for 5 years, build a home, and make some sort of improvements to the land, such as farming. Then, after the 5 years had passed and the requirements had been met, they could file for a patent. So patents were used interchangeably with a deed. So when you hear patent, it's not like patenting an invention. It was just getting, it was your deed to the land. After 6 months of residency, they could purchase the land at $1.25 per acre. And like I said, let's just breeze past the fact that this whole thing displaced, you know, hundreds of thousands of indigenous people who were already here. Excuse me. What's all this then?
Do you have a flag?
No flag, no country. These are the rules I've just made up.
Oh, excuse me. Oh, no system of ownership. Interesting.
That might come in handy later.
But don't worry. We all keep our promises. There's more of us coming, but we all keep our promises.
Then backing it up with this
gun lent to me by the National Rifle Association. That's all Eddie Izzard. Please go watch Dress to Kill.
Yes.
Absolutely.
All right. I'll have to do it.
Have you ever heard of the Timber and Stone Act of 1878?
Mm-mm.
Sounds fancy.
No, that's a new one. I know the Homestead Act.
Well, it's not a new one because it was 1878.
New one to me. New one to me, Shay.
It's another crucial piece of legislation we need to talk about for this story. This law aimed to promote the sale of public lands in the West, especially those deemed unfit for farming, but rich in valuable timber and mineral resources. Sounds like that might be interesting to somebody.
Someone's going to want it.
Yep. Like the Homestead Act, you had to be a citizen or at least claim you intended to become one.
Like Rupert Murdoch.
I thought we were talking about the Homeboy Act of 1982 with Sad P. Like, what's going on here? This is, I'm lost.
What are you drinking over there, Jason?
Right.
So these pieces of legislation were intended for individuals to settle in the West, not corporations.
But corporations are people.
I was going to say, corporations are people. That's exactly what I was thinking.
With the Timber and Stone Act, individuals could purchase up to 160 acres at $2.50 per acre. So it wasn't just them giving them the land, though that's pretty much giving them the land. There was a little cost involved, and there were a couple of hoops to jump through. So you had to appear at the local land office and file a sworn statement that the land was unfit for farming. So you just had to be like, yeah, dude.
Honor system.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Swear it's not fit for farming.
It's just crap. It's total junk. And they intended to acquire the land for personal use. They had to select a specific parcel of surveyed land. So the U.S. Department of Surveying was going out west and they were surveying these big townships. And then they were releasing the land to the public for homesteading or through this Timber and Stone Act. So it had to have already been surveyed. So you weren't supposedly supposed to be able to claim the land, but that hadn't been surveyed, but people were. So there were loopholes for that, which we will get to.
The way you keep saying timber and stone, I keep thinking it's Tim Burton.
Tim Burton stones.
Tim Burton gets stoned.
Daily. So they had to provide, allegedly, proof of eligibility and pay a filing fee. So this was your claim or entry. This is all boring. We're going to get to the good stuff, but this is setting the groundwork for what's to come. Then they had to publish a notice of their claim in the local newspaper to give others a chance to object if they believed the claim was invalid. After the paperwork was filed, they had to, quote unquote, prove up the land by establishing some sort of residence on the parcel, improving the land in some fashion, and living on it for 8 to 10 months. After fulfilling these requirements, the claimant would file the proof of compliance, which might include affidavits from neighbors or other witnesses.
See, if we had TikTok back then, you'd be able to go, we would have a billion like BTS fans going out and reporting fraudulent Timberstone claims. But yeah, we probably didn't have any.
Nobody.
People out there.
Could raise the flag. And
probably not. I think indoor toilets were still a novel idea.
Also, if I'm living on the land, it's already improved.
Exactly.
I'm fabulous.
That's all it takes. You're very
that's
present.
That's all it takes. Very humble.
Well, you just got to build an outhouse, right?
And then dude, that's an improvement.
Dang, that's an improvement.
You got a toilet?
Well.
That's an improvement. You are pooping in the woods?
That's improving
that's
the land.
That's an improvement to me. I don't know about
basically,
you guys.
So if all was good, you pay your final fees, you're issued your patent or your deed, and you go your merry way. So I know this is all sounds like boring mumbo jumbo, legal mumbo jumbo, but it's crucial to our story. Allison, you are used to getting through boring legal mumbo jumbo. So
that's my favorite
stay
stuff.
With me. All right.
It's my favorite stuff.
So besides learning the ins and outs of these laws, not to mention the potential loopholes that we've already seen, through his job with the U.S. surveyor, Sad P, or Stephen, was also making friends. He befriended people in conveniently important roles, surveyor's office, local land offices, inspectors, lawyers, politicians. Imagine the connections. He also had insider knowledge of upcoming land surveys and government land grants. So think about the advantage that that gave him. He already knew when a township was going to be surveyed. He knew when it would be available. He knew where it was. He knew where the good timber was before the public did.
Do we know how he had this insider knowledge?
Because he was working for the U.S. Surveyor Department.
Oh, so he was the insider.
You know where he was like playing the guitar in the woods?
Yes.
Right.
Gotcha.
Okay.
Serious axe man.
He was assisting the surveyor's office to survey new townships and was therefore observing the rich and plentiful timber on these lands where the best groves of trees were. So our buddy Stevens started a pretty lucrative side hustle. Hashtag girl boss. You
don't drag girls into this.
Got to appreciate his entrepreneurial spirit. As soon as the surveys for the new townships were approved, the rush for the timber claims would begin. So Stephen would sell his insider knowledge of the best claims for $25 per claim, around $700 today. And at the same time, he took out a contract to build a cabin on those claims, which is proving it up, for an additional $25. These were never meant to be lived in. They were made with scrapped wood. They were 12 by 16, one window and a fireplace. They were simply meant to be evidence of a homestead claim.
Shells.
That's like the size of my condo. That's fantastic.
For a nominal fee, I will get you this land for free.
Basically.
Yeah. Well, I'll improve it. I'll take care of all the it's like...
I'll lock it in for you. I'll make the improvements on it. I'll set it up. Mm-hmm. You just got to give me a little... Yeah. Big on the side.
It's like, I have an annuity, but I need cash now. This is the J.G. Wentworth of the 1800s.
Do you, J.G. Wentworth, please advertise with us. I will sing that song for you.
Oh, no. They just declined. We will,
Allison will sing. No, she did not agree to that. So most entrymen never spent the night there.
For 700 in today's dollars, I will.
Didn't that guy have a spear and helmet?
Spear and magic helmet?
A spear and magic
helmet. And he wants them back.
Don't we know somebody that wants their spear and magic helmet back?
Yes. Jacob Chansley, this QAnon shaman, has written a letter to the Department of Justice demanding his spear and magic helmet be returned.
I would just like a spirit magic helmet.
Magic helmet?
So soon after the final proof was made, Stephen brokered the sale of the tract to a Eureka capitalist for $800 to $1,200 per claim. So the 160 acres was one claim. Who then sold it on to the California Redwood Company for $25 per acre. So remember, they were purchased at $2.50 per acre.
But I thought this law was designed for individuals.
Well, you thought... Correct,
the individuals then sold their land to a corporation.
Exactly.
So we have our first money laundering. Well, probably not the first.
No.
But yeah,
early
shell companies.
Right. So they then transferred the tract to the Humboldt Mill and Lumber Company, who then processed the timber into lumber with a value of around $200 to $300 per acre. So remember, purchased from the government for $2.50, by the end, the value, $300 per acre. Fun fact, the Humboldt Mill and Lumber Company was started by the Corbell brothers. Yes, those Corbell brothers, the famous winemakers.
The champagne?
Oh. Yep. Oh, I thought
Brute. Corbell. Brute.
Ice cream guys.
Oh, no. That's Carvel.
It's Carvel. that's Fudgy the Whale. Just
are you thinking about ice cream again?
Was I thinking about... James Carville? No.
James Carville.
So before the Timber and Stone Act of 1873, Stephen discovered he could make good money by defrauding the government out of public lands. Initially, claimants didn't need to personally examine the land or appear at the land office for the final proof. So they just had to show up at the land office, file their claim, show citizenship papers, or take an oath to become a citizen. So if you weren't a citizen, you just had to be like, yep, I'm going to be a citizen. And they'd be like, cool.
A promise ring. A citizen promise ring from the government.
Exactly. And then they just filed the claims at the land office.
Could the indigenous people do this?
No. Okay. Of course not. They are not actually a full human.
What if they promise to be citizens?
They're not considered people. I promise to be a person. Right. I swear I am.
So the law was later amended to require the in-person final proof. But under the original terms, it was easy to make hundreds of... fraudulent claims. So the California Redwood Company sent agents to Eureka sailor boarding houses. They hired sailors by the dozens to declare their intention to become citizens. These were a lot of British soldiers at the courthouse, and then file land claims at the land office. They would sign a blank deed before the notary, collect $50, return to their ships, go on. And so these companies acquired entire townships this way.
Oh, signing blank deeds. Totes normal. Just like absolutely all of legal. Those fraudulent doctors who would sign blank COVID vaccine forms. Mm-hmm. And then you could go ahead and prove that you had the vaccine when you didn't.
I was there. I saw it.
Oh, did you?
Hey, we do have an insider on that one. So you actually
stacks
saw
of
that
cards
happen.
Just sitting there.
No.
Just signed and ready to go.
Sign it ready to
just
rock.
Put in anybody's name.
Well, they had the date they were pre-made for to make it easy for us. We were doing the vaccine clinics, trying to do as many people as possible, but Stax cards sitting there pre-filled out with the with the lot number and the date, and we're all ready to go. Well, just some went missing.
Yeah, got knocked on the floor, and then
the
some were under
the
desk.
And then you just fell
off the back of the truck.
Now, if you really wanted to check, they should have been registered with the Department of Health. But
so the General Land Office eventually discovered the fraud, suspended unpatented claims, and sent out special agents. But of course, most agents could be bribed, and only one stood up, Special Agent B.F. Bergen. And so 150 to 200 claims were suspended, and there were indictments of company members, but they just paid off prosecution and were just let go. So, you know, nothing happened.
So the charges were dropped.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Yeah. Yeah. So after the Humboldt County fraud investigations, it was feeling a little hot for Stephen, so he moved to Oregon, where the timber industry was booming. Timber barons from the Midwest and East Coast eagerly sought profitable lumber, sending thousands of men into Tillamook and Clatsop counties. The surge in filings overwhelmed the local land offices and raised suspicion in Washington, D.C. Special agents were sent to investigate, but again, they were just bribed, so nothing happened. Thousands of acres of prime timber claims in Oregon were fraudulently obtained for East Coast timber barons. So wow. Most of our land out here on the West Coast was basically stolen by the timber barons, the lumber barons, from the government. Nice job.
They frauded our fraudulent government?
Sure.
Okay.
They defrauded our bribable government.
Yes.
Got it.
Exactly. Well, let's take a little break. In the fall of 1890, Stephen met a key partner for his land fraud schemes, Franklin Pierce Mays, United States Attorney for Oregon. Mays was keen on acquiring top-tier timberland and soon became involved of most of Stephen's fraudulent deals, serving as legal counsel when needed. This is the United States Attorney for Oregon.
Okay.
So, you know, not anybody important.
Right. Just average Joe.
Yeah. Soon after, Stephen partnered with civil engineer Willard N. Jones, who had connections with Eastern Timber Barons. They devised a plan to claim uncharted land in rich in yellow fir along the Nehalem River in Tillamook County. Using Stephen's insider knowledge, they found a surveyed but unaccepted tract. So they would do the survey and then they would submit it to be accepted by the government, and then it would be released to the public. So they enlisted 40 men to file 80 claims so they could file under the Timber and Stone Act and under the Homestead Act. So you could actually do two claims of 160 acres each.
Oh, good grief.
Which is 320. 320.
Come on, Shay.
I can do it. I can do it. It's hot in here.
It's maths. It's maths.
So that's 12,800 acres that they were fraudulently filing on.
Jeez.
They built basic cabins for $10 each and lobbied for government approval of the survey. Corrupt officials, including the U.S. Deputy Surveyor, Henry Meldrum, were bribed to list these claimants as residents in the survey field notes, giving them a preference right for 90 days. So if you were already on the land that was being surveyed as an original homesteader before the Homestead Act, you had right to file claim to it before anybody else. So this guy would go in to do the survey, and he would just fill in the names of Steve's dudes that he picked up, you know, back and off the sailor boarding houses or whatever, that these people were already here, so they could file those claims before the public could.
Right of first refusal.
Yep, exactly.
This is all around the time, by the way, that Laura Ingalls became Laura Ingalls Wilder. I just wanted to put that out there.
That was my favorite show as a child.
Sorry, I immediately thought you were talking about Dr. Laura. I was like, she got real problematic real fast.
Oh, Laura Schlesinger? No, no, no.
Back in the 90s,
she was
everybody
born back
was...
then, though.
Just kidding. Bum, bum, ba-dum, bum, ba-dum. Oh, gosh. Dum, dum, da-dum, da-da-da-da. Nelly was a bitch.
Yes, Nelly was the worst.
I was so excited when Laura pushed her down
stairs. Yeah, you can tell who the young one in the no room is because she's like sitting over there in the corner going like,
huh?
What?
Okay.
This is Little House on the Prairie,
I just wanted
Shay.
To set the time scene for everyone. Yeah.
Thank you. Okay.
Yeah. Now, like if you've seen Deadwood or Little House on the Prairie, yes. We're right around
yeah,
that
exactly.
Whoa.
Time period.
Deadwood and Little House on the Prairie are very
different. There's a lot less murder in one.
Crossing a lot of genres with the getting the description out there. She's covering a lot of bases.
Well, there were families like the Ingalls, and then there were families like, you know, Swearingen.
Yeah, so
So another common scam was the in lieu of fraud, where claimants could swap land designated for schools or other government land. You would make a claim because you knew that the government was going to survey that land for a school. So you would make a claim on that before they surveyed it for a school. And then the government would be like, we're going to put a school here. And you're like, oh, shucks, you're going to have to give me something else. And then they could pick any other government owned land in lieu of those claims.
Oh, So what determines a school? I mean, because I could be teaching people how to be fabulous, and you know, that's a school.
Isn't that what you're a professor
of fabulousness. You are.
They're not determining what the schools are. They're just surveying it for the school board, for the school district,
or other federal land use.
Right, exactly, yeah, that stuff. Sort of thing. So it was the in lieu of things. So Stephen knew where the surveys were going to be, and also.
God, what a scam.
It was pretty easy to bribe the people that were doing the surveys for the school board.
I'm surprised somebody didn't name this dude the Land Fraud King. Like, I'm really kind of surprised.
That's clever.
That's land fraud. Yeah, it's well thought up.
Oh, man. That's
but that's one of the greatest downfalls of our federal government is that they are bribable, right? Because, I mean, we think about Justice Clarence Thomas. If we would have given him more than $9 million over the last 20 years, maybe we would be able to tell him how to rule on certain things. I know John Oliver offered him a brand new luxury motor coach and $2 million if he would step down from the bench, right?
But he didn't take it?
But
I'll take that.
The problem is the rich people in the country are the ones with all the money.
Yes,
and they are the ones who have the money to buy our government officials, and that puts those of us who need our government to do the right thing at a severe disadvantage.
So where do you start buying those government officials? Is there like a wacky inflatable
It's like
dude?
eBay for government officials.
Sign budget. Up. Yeah.
Depends on your
you
budget.
Bid on
well,
your...
look, here's the thing, though. You can't pay them until after they do the deed.
Well, then it's a gratuity.
That's just a tip.
And the Supreme Court just ruled that that's okay.
Yeah. You can tip them now. You can't bribe them, but you can tip them. Mm-hmm. Right.
I'm a big
and
tipper.
And pretty soon they're going to take
$2 million.
No one's ever going to take advantage of that.
Never.
And this corrupt Supreme Court is the one setting the rules for itself.
Yes. Insane.
And
insane.
Say and gutting our bribery laws, which they are recipients of.
They're ring race.
Did you say the ring wraiths?
Yeah, the nine ring wraiths.
Yes, okay. They are.
They are.
That's
Come
what
on.
I thought you said.
Yeah, the ring wraiths.
So in 1900, Stephen partnered with Charles Axel Smith. He's a Minnesota lumber baron to locate prime timber land also eyed by the Northern Pacific Railroad Company. Another giant.
Railroad barons are coming into the picture now.
Another giant perpetrator.
She called me a fascist, but I don't control the rail. Love that movie.
Another giant perpetrator of land fraud against the American government. Stephen and his buddies filed claims on 9,120 acres, and they even got discounted train fare for their entrymen to go to the land office.
I mean, if you're going to do it, just go all the way.
Different railroad companies. So they were eyeing land that the railroad company wanted, but they got in there first, filed their claims, so the railroad company found out and then sued him. And so his partner, Horace McKinley, his new partner, was finally arrested for perjury and conspiracy, but then they've got this lawyer buddy who his brother was the assistant U.S. attorney, Edward P. Mays. So he's like, don't worry, I'm going to get my brother to prosecute the case, and he's going to make sure that the charges are dismissed. So they show up to court, and he got his brother. Lo and behold, their attorney showed up as defense for the Northern Pacific Railroad companies. Like, I didn't tell you that I'm their attorney on call.
Oh, my God.
I love that. The railroad barons are like, how dare you defraud the government? That's our job.
Right.
Stepping on our turf, bro.
So eventually they had to split the claims with the railway company. But there was ongoing investigations into this fraud, which was delaying the claims. So this is where we get bigger players in here. So this timber baron called upon his powerful friends. One was U.S. Senator John H. Mitchell. He met with C.A. Smith's attorney, Cribbs, and agreed to expedite these claims for $25 per claim, by which he was paid by check.
Cash. For his friend. Always get cash.
Always get cash. So on June 4th, 1897, the Forest Management Act, also known as the Organic Act, was passed, establishing forest reserves and eventually leading to the formation of the Forest Service. This act allowed individuals with legal title to land within a new forest reserve to exchange it for an equivalent amount of other government land. So Stephen and his cronies identified a township that was in the Cascade Forest Reserve, and it was a remote rocky area, unlikely to be inspected for homesteads. So he used false names, filed claims, and claimed that they had been homesteading for 5 years. They served as witnesses for each other for the affidavits of homesteading. And despite none of these men ever having visited the land, their homesteading claims were approved within weeks because now they've got Senator Mitchell on their side. This was fun. So a few weeks later, a man from a nearby town hinted that he knew that no one lived on this claimed land, and that if they did not pay him off, he was going to turn them in. So they paid him off, but a couple weeks later, special agents showed up knocking. So they sent the special agent out with one of their cronies out there to show them the quote-unquote homesteads. Mm-hmm. Rocky, remote, not many people lived out there. So he took him on this long, winding route and showed this agent one cabin three times from different angles.
Same one. Hilarious.
And he's like, okay, I've seen enough. You're good to go.
I saw three structures.
Strangely, there was a scam like this for racing. You had to have like a certain amount of cars. And they literally took like, hey, here's all the cars we have. We're going to take you out to lunch and we'll take you to another parking lot. While they were at lunch, they moved all the cars to the other parking lot. So they only had to have that.
Nice.
Also, you keep talking about this and like special agent. I'm like, is this Special Agent Cooper? Is this Twin Peaks? Is this his first case?
Right.
It's amazing.
So despite this, further investigations by forest superintendents resulted in the claims being denied. So Mays suggested that Stephen visit Senator Mitchell in Washington, D.C. So he heads out there and visits Mitchell in his office and bribes him with $2,000 cash, which is about $75,000 in today's money. And lo and behold, the patents were finally issued. So now, folks, I am reading a book for this called Looters of the Public Domain that is 508 pages and 31 chapters.
Exciting.
Are you reading it out loud right now?
This is only chapter 7.
Like I told you, get Fred from the B-52s to read it for you.
I know.
It'd be way more entertaining.
So this guy is so long-winded. So Stephen Pewter is the author of this book, by the way. The Land Fraud King himself.
He's the author of the book.
Oh my God, he wrote his
documenting
book.
He's land
around,
fraud.
Or was this an old book?
This was written in 1907.
Okay.
And you can probably guess, from prison.
Wow.
Aren't there laws against...
Not then.
Profiting off of books...
1907.
Written from prison. This guy is just a fraud.
He's owning it.
He's owning it. The fucking cojones on this guy are just so insane.
It gets better. So this was all... Leading up to this was the boring part of it. There are many more descriptions of massive land frauds by Stephen and his cronies, but we've now grasped how it works, right? I think we have a pretty good idea of what he does, how it works. Mm-hmm. So let's skip ahead to the final downfall of the land fraud king.
Go for it.
Which we will do after the break. It all started with a crazy priest. Reverend Joseph Shell of Tillamook, Oregon, saw his poor parishioners ousted from their land claims through fraud. He began investigating, tracking the agents to their banker and lawyer. He gathered facts, records, evidence, then took his findings to local land offices, the U.S. District Attorney, the Interior Department in Washington, and the newspapers. Instead of raising an alarm, Father Shell was ridiculed, threatened, and rebuked by his own church. Despite writing to the Secretary of the Interior, Ethan Allen Hitchcock, and appealing to Senator Mitchell, well, fat good that's going to do you, nothing happened. Known as the Crazy Priest, Shell's persistent eventually piqued Hitchcock's suspicions, leading to an investigation.
Wait, hang on. This is Ethan Allen Hitchcock. So he made fantastic furniture and really scary good films.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah. I think so.
Scary furniture movies.
I like that. That's even better. Scary furniture movies.
It happened in the armoire. The settee that knew too much.
Well, I mean, your butt's on it, so it does know too much.
Deathbed.
Don't wake it up. Don't wake it up.
Don't wake
it
up.
Another source of the fraud's discovery was a letter from Arizona lawyer Juiced. We should bring back the name Juiced. J-O-O-S-T. Juiced.
Oh, wow.
Oh, 100%.
Or is it
That's
Jost?
A fantastic name.
Jost.
Either one. Jost or Juiced.
Maybe it's a soft J like Yogging.
No, is it a malt beverage with caffeine added? That's Juiced.
Juiced. Come Juiced. Kombucha Juiced.
Juiced R. Schneider. He exposed a conspiracy that he was involved with land speculators Frederick A. Hyde and John A. Benson in California and Arizona. They were doing the same thing, except for mineral rights, because there wasn't a lot of timber in Phoenix.
Copper. Mm.
Yeah. These two orchestrated grand-scale frauds using dummy homesteaders on school lands and mapping forest reserves to cover these claims. So they would actually go in, map out the reserve, and then give it to the government official and say, you should map this one because it favors us.
And then call me when you're done.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I'm not surprised. I mean, that's one of the three C's of Arizona.
It's corruption.
Copper. Cotton. Five C's.
Corruption. Is it five C's?
It's now six.
It's six.
Okay, give me the six C's.
Climate, cattle, cotton, citrus, copper, corruption.
Oh, wow. Fantastic. Wow. Well, you're a better Arizona than I am.
I know my state seals, bitch. I don't know why I keep saying bitch today. It's so rude.
It's because you're hot. You're bitchy. B.F. Allen, the forest superintendent of Los Angeles, would accept their maps and recommend the reserves to his officials. They exploited in lieu thereof claims to claim prime timber and mineral-rich lands, which they sold at great profits. Their fraud involved many clerks from the land office and the Department of the Interior, the Surveyor General, and possibly Governor Henry T. Graft of California. Almost every single school selection entry in California and Arizona were bogus.
Wow.
At that time.
Wow.
Arizona only has two schools, so that's okay.
And this is the early 1900s, so this is before statehood for Arizona, really.
Yeah.
Right?
That's correct. Yeah. 1912.
Yeah, this was late 1800s, early 1900s. So the big trials began in, I think, 1903. So it was all leading up to this. Now, this had been going on for four decades.
Oh.
Holy smokes.
Hitchcock approached Binger Herman, the commissioner of the General Land Office, with these accusations.
And a script for the birds.
What do you think?
That's right.
I can't get over
from
these names.
I know.
Binger. We need to bring that name. Juiced, Binger, Axel.
Juiced, Binger, Axel, Hitchcock.
Ethan Allen.
And Ethan Allen.
So Herman admitted to possible misconduct because he knew about all of it. He was part of it. So Hitchcock demanded his resignation, but Herman was like, look, my daughter is getting married soon, and it would just be so devastating to the family if I resigned now. So he ran crying to Senator Mitchell, who we already have established as part of this fraud. And he's like, you can delay your resignation until after your daughter's wedding. Well, Herman took this opportunity to go into his office and burn 35 letter books, claiming they were personal.
Oh, so it's like it's like Mark Meadows's hero.
Yeah.
No shit. Yeah, that's amazing. You come to me.
Document after document after document.
Right. On the day of my daughter's birthday.
Right. It was his daughter's wedding.
I'm sorry, the day of my daughter's wedding.
The Oregonian calculated that if true, Herman would have written 10 personal letters daily throughout his term. He was indicted on charges from...
Unless you're Marjorie Taylor Greene, we say indicted.
To be fair, she needs some help. Not just with
forms.
Spelling.
Multiple forms.
She needs some help into a prison cell. Mm-hmm.
Loony bin.
He was indicted on charges from evidence destruction to conspiracy to commit fraud, but two juries failed to convict him. Despite the scandal, he was reelected to his congressional seat 4 months later.
Is he Republican?
It probably helped him.
Yeah. Yes.
Legend.
So Hitchcock knew this fraud ran deep. He hired the star of the Secret Service, investigator William J. Burns. Burns was an old school. Exactly. Burns was an old school detective, the kind you read about in books.
Smithers.
His suspicion was universal. The president once complained that Burns thought everyone was a thief until proven innocent.
They kind of are in this story.
To which Burns replied, well, they are here in Washington.
I was going to say it.
Thank you.
Me and Burns. Make it along the
Burns,
same line.
Burns, my boy.
Burns uncovered
too much.
Burns uncovered a stream of corruption from Washington through the land office of the Interior Department to California, the timber barons and the Southern Pacific Railroad, which had corrupted state government and California's representation in the Senate, House, and Executive Department, were deeply involved. The railroad was also in the in lieu of land business. And Hyde and Benson, who we mentioned a couple paragraphs ago, they would draw maps to bypass railroad land so that they didn't piss off the railroad.
Well, you know.
Because that's where they'd really
they're
find consequences.
Smart. Don't want to piss yeah. off the railroad.
That's the only place there were consequences.
We're not going to piss off the railroads. Deeper pockets than anybody else.
For real. And the ability yes. to move stuff.
Yeah. yeah. You need to get your shit out there to cut down those trees. You got to talk to us.
Need to get the timber somewhere. Yeah. yeah. I mean,
right. Exactly.
You got to move it back to the East Coast. You got to talk to us.
Well, you piss somebody off and you're not going to get a depot in your town where you need it.
Right.
They're going to be like, we're going to go to Tacoma instead.
There's a million ways the railroad could make your life miserable.
Absolutely.
You know, you'd piss me off and you won't get a good grade on your design project.
I don't think that's going to ruin a statehood.
A death knell to commerce.
That's right, a death knell.
So while investigating land frauds in California, Burns found evidence of similar frauds in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Colorado. Secretary Hitchcock then assigned Special Agent Colonel A.R. Green. Hitchcock assigned Green to Oregon. Unfortunately, Green was not a quiet investigator. Proceeding with what critics called one brass band playing in front of him and another in his rear.
That's oh what my they God.
Said. They wow. said that, not me.
You didn't make that up?
I was going to say.
I did not make that
end,
up.
At the end, he said, I'm going to go home and sleep with my wife.
I'm not a quiet pooper, but you know, it's not a brass band back there.
I don't know. I think Rich would probably accuse me of having a brass band in my rear.
I was going to say, God. I might know somebody who can.
I'm still trying to figure out these old-timey insults.
They're the best.
You got a brass band behind you there.
What? Does that even... What?
Don't talk to me like that.
Despite this, his investigation led to Sad P.
Oh,
our
yeah,
Stephen A. Pewter, we come back to him. Along with Marie Ware, Emma Watson, Horace McKinley, and Dan Tarpley were indicted in 1903 and brought to trial the next year. Prosecutors Francis J. Henney and John H. Hall, remember the name, handled the case. Pewter confessed to the jury, admitting he had paid a $2,000 bribe to Senator Mitchell.
So I have a question really quick. So if John, is it John H. Hall?
Yes.
So if he gets a Hall named after him at a...
It's a Hall Hall.
Is it a Hall Hall?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'm really more concerned about Emma Watson. I mean, I know. What are we going to do with the...
All right. So Pewter finally, he was up there. He spilled the beans. He confessed to his deal and his bribe of Senator Mitchell. So now Senator Mitchell has been brought into this case. So on December 6, 1904, the jury returned a guilty verdict for all defendants except Marie Ware, who was acquitted. Additionally, Frederick Hyde and John Benson... Those were the Arizona land fraud kings, were charged with fraudulently obtaining titles to school lands in California and Oregon and with bribery.
There's a town in Arizona named Benson.
I wonder if that's that guy. Let's look into it. Oh, my God. This was widely reported on January 1st, 1904. On February 17th, Just J. Schneider was arrested by Burns with bail set at $35,000. Wow. That's equivalent to $1.2 million today.
Wow. Excellent.
Good. Excellent. What year was he arrested?
1904.
Got it.
Henry P. Diamond was also indicted, which we didn't even get in him. There's so many players in this. This could have been a 3-hour podcast. Long story short.
Too late.
Thank you. The trial, delayed multiple times, began on April 1st, 1908, 4 years later.
Wow.
On June 22nd, guilty verdicts were returned for Hyde and Schneider, while Benson and Diamond were acquitted. But according to Pewter, the scheme's ringleader was John H. Hall. the then U.S. District Attorney for Oregon, and was one of the prosecutors in Peter's case.
Naturally.
And 4 years, I mean, that sounds like our current legislative system.
Peter claimed George Sorensen, another guy we didn't even talk about, offered Hall a $5,000 bribe to squash the indictments against Peter, McKinley, Ware, and Watson. At Hitchcock's suggestion, the president, which I think at this point was Theodore Roosevelt. Theodore was
definitely Ronald Reagan.
Before or after?
No, that, he was starring in his like 37 movie.
Yeah, that's probably true.
So he was planning the Redwoods.
The president removed
That was my mom.
The president removed Hall from his role as U.S. District Attorney. Hinley later indicted Hall for failing to prosecute land companies engaged in fraud and for using his knowledge of illegal activities to blackmail political opponents. Hall was found guilty in 1908, but was later pardoned by President William Howard Taft and returned to private legal practice.
Oh, it was Teddy Roosevelt. Okay. He was reelected in 1904.
Okay. Initially, over 1,000 indictments were issued in the case.
Oh, my God.
But
that's pretty good.
Yeah. Henney narrowed it down to the 35 most egregious offenders. He persuaded Stephen Pewter to cooperate, leading to charges against Senator Mitchell and Congressman John N. Williamson, both indicted on December 31st, 1904.
Oh, happy new year.
Yep.
Yeah. So wait a minute. How many indictments did they narrow it down to?
35.
Well, you know, one dude recently that had very, very close.
I know. This was 35 different people.
That's a bunch of people.
Well, that's indictments. Those are felony counts.
Right. Oh, that was 34
felony counts in
very
one
close.
Single indictment.
For one dude. Wow. Yeah. That's amazing. Well,
four indictments, 88 counts. It was 91, but three were dismissed in Georgia.
Oh.
So on July 3rd, 1905, Mitchell was found guilty of using his position to help a client of his law firm acquire patents to fraudulent land claims, accepting bribes, and falsifying evidence.
By the way, today he wouldn't be able to be prosecuted for that.
That's true. Okay. He was sentenced to 6 months in jail and fined $1,000.
Oh.
I mean, that was like, you know, $10,000 today.
That's actually a pretty typical sentence for a first-time offender, assuming he was
like
a first-time offender
for
a nonviolent crime.
Mitchell appealed, but died from complications of a tooth extraction a few months later.
Egads.
Isn't that the dream?
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
Williamson
That makes my teeth hurt just thinking about that.
It was the 1900s.
Die. Oh, that's right. It was old-timey doctors, right? Yep. Like, oh, you got ghosts in your blood. You should do cocaine about it.
And if that doesn't help, pour some laudanum on it.
Laudanum. That's how you die from a tooth extraction. It's probably the medicine used to treat it.
Suck on a leech. You'll be fine.
Suck on a leech.
Stick some coffee up your butt.
The leech sucks on you, Shane.
Put a brass band in your butt.
Williamson was also convicted, but his conviction was overturned by the Supreme Court in 1908. Letting criminals get away with it since 1908. Supreme Court.
Since before that.
Right, yeah.
But I mean, we go back to Reconstruction if you want to.
Nine ring wraiths.
So what happened to our good buddy, Stephen Pewter?
He wrote a book.
He wrote a book. He did. He wrote a book from jail. His and McKinley's sentencing was deferred in exchange for testimony against Mitchell and Hall. But in the meantime, he fled to Boston. Now, this is where things get wild. Detective Burns, our detective, who I see in a fedora and a long coat, right? Mm-hmm. Chased him down and took him into custody in 1906. But 30 minutes later, Pewter suddenly drew a revolver. And after a fight where Pewter slammed Burns against a wall, he ran away down an alley. He was able to make his way to Alameda, California.
Whoa.
From Boston.
Yeah. Which that means that's like four trains and like 10 days.
Oh, yeah.
He's got buddies
weeks.
In the train business.
True story.
The train business.
I need to start working that train business. You know anybody in the train business? Jody? Anybody in the train business?
Nobody.
That's not going to help anything. They could get you from the port of Tacoma to Fredrickson.
The port of Tacoma to the port of Tacoma.
Right. Yeah. Basically, that's it.
One side and the other. That's what I can help you out with.
Bad escape plan.
So he made his way to Alameda, California, where he took rooms in a lodging house before visiting his wife in Berkeley. The Secret Service quickly learned of his presence because he's just running around visiting people and apprehended him on May 20th, 1906. The Secret Service men said that he did not willingly resign himself to his fate, but showed fight and attempted to draw a revolver. He continued to resist arrest as they took him to the station. Upon inspecting his room at the boarding house, they found a Winchester rifle and a Colt revolver, which they described as an arsenal.
Well, they shouldn't look in my closet.
He was sentenced to 2 years in Multnomah County Jail and a $7,500 fine.
What is it about Multnomah?
I don't know. The serial killers and
nine
criminals.
Out of 10 true crime stories I watch come from Multnomah.
Ah, this county, Jesus.
Fungus. I bet you there's a fungus.
Could be.
While in jail, I mean, the largest organism in the world is in Oregon.
Mm-hmm. Is it trees?
It's fungus.
Okay.
Yeah. It's the humongous fungus. Guys, go back and listen to our episode called The Humongous Fungus. This mushroom is a mass murderer. All right.
At least he wasn't a land front king.
So he got 2 years.
I don't know. He is destroying timber. But just very, very, very slowly.
And I bet probably a year and a half of that sentence is because he ran away.
Probably, yeah.
And the resisting.
Yeah.
So while in jail, he collaborated with Horace Stevens, a former general land office clerk, to write a tell-all account of his exploits, Looters of the Public Domain, which I gamely attempted to read for this episode. But like I said, I gave up after seven chapters because it was so boring. It
I
was
feel like he
like,
had a lot to say about himself, didn't
this,
he?
This is how a normal paragraph would go. I visited John Mitchell's offices, but he wasn't there. So I sat in his secretary's office for a while, and she said he wouldn't be back until after lunch. So then I went to a cafe and waited, and then I came back for a while, and then I sat in the lobby for another 20 minutes, and then I came in and he greeted me warmly, and I sat on the couch and he sat on the other side of his desk, and I said, I'm having some problems with these land frauds. Oh, never mind. Excuse minute, me, not frauds, not frauds.
Minute by minute rundown.
That is what this book is. Pewter was
fun,
pissed off because Senator Mitchell threw him under the bus and said, I didn't do anything. It was all Stephen Pewter. So he decided to write this book from jail as his revenge. He was like, I'm going to tell everything.
I am your retribution.
And he had 2 years to sit around in jail and write this
2 years.
So this
very
is
long
a revenge
book. It is okay. A revenge book. He was pardoned by Teddy Roosevelt and was released on his 51st birthday in 1907. He died on May 10th, 1931. So he lived quite long after that at the age of 75. Now his partner, Horace McKinley, had a more flamboyant end. After the trial, he and Marie Ware, who they were having an affair, were married in Chicago in 1905. It was reported that after the wedding, they visited La Crosse, Wisconsin, where Horace has relatives. Now, this is important. Why?
Did Emma Watson come and shoot them both in bed?
Also, there's
in a jealous rage.
There's a mountain named, or that was named McKinley.
So maybe he was back to his old tricks, because the Polk County Observer reported on October 5th, 1905, that he had been observed spending a week in the Deschutes timber with Paul McHugh of La Crosse, Wisconsin. And then new evidence turned up that implicated Pewter and McKinley in a new fraud dealing, selling fake land certificates to timbermen in Wisconsin with forged documents after they had already been convicted of the other land fraud trial. So they get out of jail and they go back to their dealing, but apparently there's a bunch of suckers in Wisconsin. I think that's just where all the timber barons were.
That sounds familiar.
Rumors circulated that Horace had gone to Japan because he went on the lam when they were looking for him. And this is also when Pewter was on the run after his run-in with Burns. It was finally confirmed that Horace had fled the country to China, accompanied by a woman described as a Little Egypt dancing girl. So now, Little Egypt was a common name for belly dancers of the time that would do these kind of exotic belly dances that were had that Eastern mysticism sort of thing. So he had been spending a lot of time at this theater where she was performing.
Is it a Greek restaurant?
Yeah.
No doubt.
And had become enamored with her. And apparently she felt the same way because she went off to China with him. He had just gotten married, by the way. Like, he got married in May. This is December.
Oh, wow. Well, that didn't last too long. Man, the honeymoon is over fast.
Yes. So they went to China. There was a lot of rumors about them separating and that he was off to Guatemala. But other stories reported that he had started a brokerage firm in China, which failed, and then ended up running a roulette wheel at a casino in China. He was arrested in Manila and sent to a prison at Tenzin.
In Manila, from China, like the Philippines.
Yeah. I guess.
That's a stretch to go.
Yeah.
That's kind of crazy.
But he escaped prison. before, because they were going to extradite him to the U.S., but he escaped prison before an officer from Portland could arrive. But he was recaptured a few weeks later in Manchuria.
He gets around. Candidate?
Of course.
He was finally transported back to the United States in February 1908 and arrested as soon as he stepped from the gangplank of his ship in San Francisco, then immediately put on a ship to Portland after spending a week in the same cell recently vacated by his buddy Stephen Pewter. He was sentenced to 2 years and fined $7,500. When learning he was avoiding prison time and was instead going to be in county jail, because they were, prison here was McNeil Island.
If anybody knows McNeil Island from the Northwest, that is not someplace you really want to go.
No, we need to do an episode on McNeil Island.
It's a podcast on its own.
Yeah, absolutely.
That would run for years and years.
That's where a lot of stuff happened. Bad people went. Yeah.
Yeah. Not only the people that went there, the stuff that happened on the island. And you can see it from I-5 driving towards Olympia. It's fantastic.
It's plopped right down in the middle of the Puget Sound. That's beautiful. Correct.
Well, that means at any minute it'll be a reality show.
Oh, there we go.
Very soon. Or a resort. Joe Rogan.
MILF Island.
So when he learned that he was avoiding prison time on McNeil Island, he threw his hat into the air with joy. His light sentence...
I just picture Mary Tyler Moore.
His light sentence was a preliminary to McKinley becoming a witness for the government in cases yet to be called. This is very familiar. There was a pervert that died in prison that had a similar setup. During his tenure at the county prison, frequent criticisms were made of the freedom accorded to the convict. It was said he was doing little more than eating at the jail at government expense, otherwise at liberty to come and go as he pleased.
Jeffrey Epstein.
God, you beat me to it. Damn it.
But part of a sweetheart deal from given to him by Acosta, who Trump then later made his Secretary of Labor.
So gross. It was day release, like work release.
Yeah, it was like it reminded me of Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, where he's like, oh, jailer, I would like to use your phone. Yes. You know, and he's like, what kind of jail is this? No, it wasn't Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. It was My Blue Heaven.
My Blue Heaven.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, he was picked up from jail in his limo.
Yep.
To go to work.
Let
for the
out
day.
At 8 o'clock yep. every morning. So
Monday he was.
Through, Saturday, too.
McKinley was granted privilege such as taking a steam bath at a bathhouse across the street from the jail every day. He was given an hour and a half.
In San Diego. Bathhouses are they're different.
I don't know if that was the same in Oregon. He ate at the same table as the jailer and Sheriff Stevens' deputies. He was not obliged to work, and his wife had access to his quarters at all times.
Sounds awful.
He was released from jail in November of 1909 and then arrested just 1 week later and brought into court for trial in the suit brought by the La Crosse, Wisconsin timber barons.
Hang on a second. His wife that he left.
Mm-hmm. Oh, she stayed with him.
I wouldn't want her to have access if I had run away with Little Egypt to Manchuria.
Right.
I'd be like, no. You can deny her access. It's okay.
I'm going to keep these
Little Egypt
doors
you can let
between
in,
us but, and her.
Exactly.
So this case brought out even more heavy hitters. Attorney Franklin Pierce Mays, who had represented Stephen Pewter and the railroad company, was finally implicated for his roles in the frauds. Millionaire lumber baron C.A. Smith and his attorney Frederick A. Cribbs were brought into the case, and they were found guilty in September of 1910. Entitled to 37 quarter sections of land in Lynn and Lane counties in Oregon was canceled and returned to the United States. So during these trials, they were able to take some of the land back.
Good.
Horace Greeley McKinley died on April 28, 1934, age of 65. His obituary noted his part in the Oregon land fraud trials and that he was later active in the Montana oil business. So he went on to do just fine.
So he came back from Japan?
No, this is McKinley, not the other guy.
McKinley came back from
not
China.
Pewter.
So who went to Japan?
Nobody. It was rumored. You know how the papers were back there? Yeah. They're like, so Mrs. Green went and visited Miss Edna Watson and also... This guy went off to Japan with a dancing girl.
I figured if some dude named Horace is in Japan.
Right. Side note, Eva Rowland, the Little Egypt dancer, was later banned from performing in San Francisco after an affair with policeman Angelo J. Rocca caused his dismissal from the force, and they got married. Okay, and that's as much information about the Oregon land flood trials that I could fit in one episode.
Land flood. I was like, wait, I didn't hear about the flood.
Land flood trials.
Flood.
So This was a toe dip into the world of land fraud that happened in the late 1800s throughout the country that I had never heard about before. And I bet that you guys hadn't either.
Nope, I had no idea.
So this was all news. Mm-hmm.
But I think it's a really fascinating story about... you know, about this huge, massive mm-hmm. land fraud, 1,000 indictments that they had to whittle down to 35 just so they could handle
it. Yeah, it's crazy.
Right. So much work.
This has been most modern anything on the internet that reports it. It's a one-page blurb.
Mm-hmm. So this is an untold story.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that there's something
except
to be
by the guy
here.
Who did it.
That's the best part.
Which I'm like, how much of this do I trust of him? Because he's going to paint it in a...
Well, you don't take his word for it. You look at this court document.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's the kicker for this. The only person who's told this story is the perpetrator of the fraud himself.
Mm-hmm. And his neighbor.
And now we're here to tell the rest of it. Mm-hmm.
That's it. That's it. We're done.
Thank you
awesome.
So much.
I don't have
this
a great
so
bow for it.
Amazing.
It was fun.
Yes. Thank you.
Awesome.
Yeah, this I'm is never inviting Jason back to my house.
Yeah,
ever.
That's why I'm sticking it in my memory to make exactly. sure I don't repeat mistakes.
Yes, because you want to think of it fondly, but else you don't want to repeat.
Yes.
The mistakes of history by inviting Jason. No, this yes. is awesome. What you guys have put together. This is a beautiful studio and
thank you.
Fantastic podcast. Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for being on here.
And I can't
it.
Wait to tell all the Leguminati to come and take a listen.
I will love right. it.
We thank have the coolest you. Community yeah. of listeners by. Like mm-hmm. they're just the coolest and they are super supportive.
Yep.
They're all makers and creators and intensely smart people themselves. So it's just a wonderful, wonderful community. So
yeah.
thank
Glad
you.
Awesome. Thank you. Appreciate yeah. it. Yep. Well, everyone, you can find the lovely and wonderful and intelligent and
Step.
Oh God, stop feeding. Just stop.
Jason thought you were talking about him.
Jason Milligan.
Oh, oh my God. Yeah, keep going.
No,
what if else Jason thought it was about him, he would have said, go on.
Yeah, go on.
If it's about anybody else, he's like, shut
Professor,
up.
I'm listening.
Professor Milligan. And you can find Allison Gill in the Daily Beans podcast, Cleanup on Aisle 45, the Jack podcast, and I mean, just generally
much,
out there
much more.
Doing political, she's doing the Lord's work,
doing the Lord's work,
and bringing some sanity to this insanity. Thank you so much, both of you. You can follow us on all your podcast platforms, but go to our website first for everything, rainydayrabbitholes.com. Make sure you tell a friend, please. That's the best way to support us. You can also join our Patreon where you get bonus episodes like our Bigfoot erotica episode, which we'll just send to you, Allison, for your
Thanks.
Gracious to turn off.
They will send to you for so you cannot listen. No,
exactly. So you can be like, what the fuck?
Bigfoot erotica.
They are Bigfoot perverts. So thank you
we
so much, guys.
Discovered.
We will see you next time.
See you down the rabbit hole.
Allie's got a book.
No, not yet.
It's coming soon.
No.
It's called My Best Friend Jason.
Written by Jason.
Written by the only perpetrator of this crime, Jason.
It's called
S.
Don't Wake the Brass Band in My Butt.
That's the subtitle. My Best Friend Jason.
Don't Wake the Brass Band in My Butt.
Make a little brass band in your butt. Not to put too fine a point on it. Yeah. Covered in bees in your bonnet. Yeah, we'll do it. We'll mix it in with Eddie Izzard. It'll be great.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.